So in my talk, I want to talk a bit about n-body simulations of globular cluster, especially of n-body simulations for the for massive central black holes in globular cluster. And I want to talk a bit about some observational evidence for massive black holes in some clusters, and also about some n-body simulations me and my co-workers have done on Gap 6 for these clusters. So first question is, why should one wonder about massive black holes in star clusters? Well, I think there are several reasons. One thing is that there are several channels, I would say, how such massive black holes could form. And for example, one way is in clusters which have very, very small relaxation times of 100 mega years or less, when massive stars can spiral in to the centers of these clusters while they are still on the main sequence and while they are still fairly, fairly big. And when these massive stars spiral into the centers, clusters go into core collapse, so you have binaries forming. And in these binaries, they undergo interactions with field stars, and you have very, very high chances for collisions. So these massive stars collide in the center, and once you have such a massive star who has undergone several collisions, it's significantly larger or more massive than the other stars, and then the chance for undergoing further collisions rises and rises. And that will lead to a runaway growth of a massive central star in the cluster, and Portugis Swart and Macmillan have recently estimated that it can contain up to 0.1% of the total cluster mass. If you think that it is maybe a fairly massive star cluster, which has 10 to the 6 solar masses, you can create a massive black hole which has about 1,000 or several thousand solar masses that way. And that would be, for example, very interesting because it has recently also been suggested by Ebi Suzaki and others that if such a cluster is very close to the galactic center, it will spiral into the center, where the star cluster itself will dissolve due to the rising tidal forces, but it will at least be sufficient to bring such 1,000 solar masses black holes into the centers of galaxies, and where they could also merge with each other and then really form these supermassive black holes that one sees in the centers. And there are also several other ways how to create massive black holes in the centers of clusters, so there are really quite some good reasons to believe that these objects might exist, at least in some type of globular cluster. And the second thing why it's interesting to study massive black holes in star clusters is that recently there have come out two papers which claim that people see evidence for massive central black holes in globular clusters. And one cluster is M15, which is a core collapse cluster in our galaxy, where Gersten et al. Have shown some observations, and the other cluster is G1, which is one of the most massive globular clusters in Andromeda, where Gebhardt et al. Have shown some evidence. And basically what these two groups have done was always the same. I mean, they have taken some, measured some velocities or velocity dispersions in the centers with HST, and then they have taken the the light profile of these clusters, as one sees it, they have deprojected it, and integrated it to give to get an integrated luminosity function. And then we have used a Gene-6 equation, which allows you to calculate the velocity profile together with a constant mass to light ratio. And that way, they could estimate the projected velocity dispersion of these clusters. And when they fitted this velocity dispersion to the observed velocity profile in the outer parts, they found that there is a mismatch in the center. And one cluster, for example, is M15. I show you here the observations of Gersten et al. First, you have to look at this figure. The solid black line gives you the observed velocity dispersion, which basically rises from the outermost parts towards the center, and in the core becomes essentially flat. And then these these thinner lines show you the predictions of the code I've just described before. So in the outer parts, you can fairly well fit the observed velocity dispersion. And if you assume there's no central black hole or nothing, then you arrive at these lowermost curves, and you can see that lies really significantly below the observation. So there must be some unseen mass. in the center. And Gerson et al. Have thought about the central point mass, a black hole, and when they get these curves, depending on the mass of the central black hole, and they found they can get the best agreement with observations about for a black hole of about 4,000 solar masses. Well, that was in their original paper. Where they have also used some, not only a constant M over L model, but also some model where M over L is varying from some other paper. But in the original paper, we found it doesn't make much difference. It all produces 4,000 solar masses, but later there was some error found in that model that they used. And when they used the corrected model, the black hole mass went a little bit down to about 2,000 solar masses, but they still think we have a detection of a black hole in that cluster.
Does this assume random orbits, not radially elongated orbits?
No, it's isotropic.
Isotropic?
Yeah.
And if they were radially elongated, you could explain this perhaps a lot
of them? Probably, I mean, when.
Okay. Now, that's tried with radial orbits, and the amount of radial anisotropy that is required is too much to be a stable configuration based on the amount of density.
Yeah, it would probably destroy that shiny radial orbit to some extent. And the second cluster where some evidence was reported was G1. And here I show you the velocity measurements of Gebhardt et al. Where first they found that there is some indication for G1 that it is a rotating cluster. And the lower panel shows you also the velocity dispersion, which is more or less flat in the center. And when you use the before described machinery to the velocity measurements, you can basically fit the mass-to-light ratio of G1 and a central black hole mass. And what we found is that the mass-to-light ratio is about in the range 2.6 to 2.8. And that the best fitting models also require a black hole mass for G1 of about 20,000 solar masses. Now it's a bit more massive than what people have found in M15, but G1 is also about 10 times more massive than M15. So, but I mean, all these results were obtained with really quite simplified models, because you just took the observed velocity dispersion and assume the constant mass-to-light ratio. And in case of globular clusters, it might not be the best thing to do, because you know, if you have globular clusters, you have dynamical relaxation and you have mass segregation. In the normal globular cluster, the bright stars are not the most massive component, because we have only 0.7, 0.8 solar masses, and the most massive stars are the compact remnants, neutron stars, black hole, and white dwarfs. And you would expect, I mean, these objects will sink into the center. But on the other hand, these are very, very faint objects, and so the mass-to-light ratio in the globular cluster must change. It must be different in the center from the outer part. So the question is, how would all these conclusions change if you really run some realistic simulations of globular cluster and try to fit the observations with these? And so recently, I mean, there has been a tremendous increase in the type of simulations that we can form by in-body simulations, and Steve McMillan has talked about that already, and I have also made a figure which shows you the speed-up of the GRAPE 6 that was finished in July 2001 in Tokyo. I mean, here what I've shown is just the time which is needed to calculate one n-body unit as a function of the number of cluster stars. And I compare the GRAPE 6, the speed, with the fastest computer before, the GRAPE 4, and also with a parallel computer. There you can see, I mean, at the low end, basically all three types of simulations have approximately the same speed. And the reason is, I mean, if you have only a few thousand stars, then most of the work is still done on the host machine. And the GRAPEs are not so busy, and so all types of simulations have about the same speed. However, if you increase the number of cluster stars more and more, then the calculation of the interaction, gravitational interaction between the cluster stars becomes more and more the most expensive part. And then you can see, even if you have a pendulum cluster, soon most of time is spent really in calculation of the forces and the computational time increases about this n square. And so soon the whole simulation takes longer and longer. But on the Drake, on the other hand, the computation of the gravitational force is very, very quick. And so the Drake scales really with something which is still quite close to n, and therefore gets more and more competitive, or faster compared to the other methods.
What is an n-body unit?
N-body unit is about 1/3 of a half-mass crossing time. And you can see at the high end, for example 100,000 stars or something, you're about, with the Grape 6, about 10 to 30 times faster than with a parallel computer of the Grape 4. And that means you have, for example, a star cluster which is in a tidal field and has some mass function, and about 150,000 stars, that will take about 30 days on Grape 6 to be simulated until complete evaporation. And in Tokyo, I mean, we have a special advantage that we have 16 Grape 6, where we can run clusters. So it means even at such an incredible large particle number, we can still do small parameter studies of globular cluster evolution. And so we did some simulations for both M15 and G1. Now, as I've told you before, I mean, M15 is a cluster, is a core collapse cluster. And in the core collapse cluster, the central density is not created by the initial star formation of the cluster, but by the core collapse. And that means basically all core collapse clusters have more or less the same central density profile. So for M15, when we wanted to compare some simulations with the observations, we only had to make sure we run a cluster that starts with a basically realistic initial condition and goes into core collapse at or slightly before one Hubble time. And so what we did was we simulated the evolution of a multi-mass star cluster, which had a Kupa 2001 IMF, between certain limits, and we simulated star formation with the Hurley et al. Routines. When the initial number of cluster stars was 130,000, which is pretty large, and the initial density profile was a King W0 equals 7 model, by which we just made sure that the cluster went into core collapse at about 12 GeV. And now, in the initial cluster, I mean, I had a fairly low mass, high mass cutoff. It was only 15 solar masses. So the cluster basically didn't form any black holes. And the neutron stars were the most massive components. But for core collapse and the central central density, pretty important. Now, unfortunately, for neutron stars, such neutron stars, when they form, they get some kick velocity. And for globular clusters, most of the neutron stars are removed from the cluster. But the fraction, how many will remain, is fairly unknown, maybe 10% or something. But it's quite unclear. So we did two simulations, which had either 0% neutron star retention rate, where we removed all the neutron stars and only the white dwarfs remained, or we had 100% neutron star retention rate. So just to see the influence of the neutron star retention rate on our results. But so nature should be somewhere in between. Zero. Yeah, I didn't have any primordial binaries. Now, so what we did was we simulated the evolution of a cluster up to core collapse, and then for 500 mega years after core collapse as well, then took 10 snapshots equally spaced in these 500 mega years just to get good statistics, put all these snapshots together, and then put our model cluster to the distance of M15, and then tried to compare our results with the observation. So first thing, what we compare is the density profile. And here I've shown two components. First, the bright stars, which create all the cluster light, and secondly, the most massive stars, the most massive white dwarfs, and the neutron stars. And as you can see, I mean, in the outer parts, they have about equal density for some time. But then, if you go towards the center, when the neutron stars and dwarfs are much more concentrated, which is the effect of the mass segregation. And in the center, they have an over density about the factor of 10 or so. And if you look at the density profiles, okay, the white Rossen neutron stars, we have a density profile which is very similar to what you get, what you would expect from a theory of core collapse. And on the other hand, the white stars, they have a very much, much flatter density profile. And the runoff surface density goes with r to the power of minus 0.8, which is exactly the same slope that you observe in M15. So basically, the observed luminosity profile, we can fit very well with our simulation. And similarly, if you look at the velocity dispersion, we also get a profile which is very, very similar to M15. We have a rise towards the center from the halo, and in the center itself, the velocity dispersion is basically constant. So these 2 points already, our simulations can very, very well reproduce. And then the third thing is, what happens if you try to fit the velocity dispersion? And there, we basically did the same thing as the observers did. We took the, some density profile of the bright stars and then used different cluster potentials. The first cluster potential was coming from if you use the realistic cluster potential from all stars and then make a prediction. This is the red curve here. And as you can see, I mean, the blue points are observed velocity dispersion of the bright stars, and the red curve is just a prediction if you use the correct cluster potential. There you can see, I mean, they absolutely agree, as we should. If you use the real cluster potential, you can make a successful prediction of the velocity dispersion. And then second thing we did was we took a cluster potential which just comes from the observed light distribution, and that is significantly more extended than the real cluster potential. Then, if you just take that, you end up with the lowest green curve. So you can successfully predict the outer part, but in the center, you also fall short of the real velocity dispersion. This is exactly as in M15. And that is, of course, due to the fact that the central concentration of white dwarfs and neutron stars are not considered in this lowermost green curve. If you consider it, you end up with a green curve. But you can also make an analysis similar to Gerson et al. And add massive central black holes to the cluster. And then you end up with these other green curves. And you can also fit the velocity dispersion at some black hole mass. And interestingly, the ratio of the black hole mass to the total cluster mass is exactly similar to what Gerson et al. Got in M15. So also that third point, I mean, our simulations create the same mismatch that you see in M15. And so basically, we can really show that the central concentration of white dwarfs and neutron stars can explain all the observational data for M15. And interestingly, our results don't depend on the assumed neutron star retention fraction. If you have 0%, you still get a mismatch, and also 100%, the mismatch is almost the same. The reason is, I mean, if you don't have any neutron stars, then really the massive white dwarfs remove all the bright stars out of the center. So I think for M15, we can really explain the observations without a central black hole. And so we moved on to the second cluster, G1. And now with G1, there's a problem. I mean, that cluster is definitely not in core collapse. So if you want to fit all the observations, you also have to find a starting condition which really fits the observed light distribution in G1. And that is a lot harder. So what we did was we were taking clusters with 65,000 stars, also taking the Cooper IMF and Hurley et al. Stellar evolution as before. And we assume that these clusters are isolated, which is, should be a good assumption because G1 is first very massive, and secondly also very far from the center of M31, so tidal effects are unimportant. And then we took a starting condition King model with different central concentrations, and we varied the half-mass radius, the mass of G1, and the central concentration until we found a model which fits the observed light profile best. And since our clusters are isolated, we basically have to consider two evolution mechanisms. One is relaxation, and the second is stellar evolution. So stellar evolution can be modeled correctly by just choosing the right time scale. And for relaxation, well, that's a bit more difficult, because I mean our clusters only contain 65,000 stars, while G1 has maybe about 50 million. So our clusters are much, much smaller and have a shorter relaxation time. And to compensate that for, we have just increased the radius of our cluster until we match the relaxation time of G1. And so with that recipe, we did about several dozen simulations and looked if we can reproduce the density profile of the light profile of G1 as it is observed. And this slide shows you the outcome. What we found is that the cluster, which starts with an initial central concentration parameter of 7.5, gives the best fit to the light profile. So this is shown here. The red curve is the surface density as observed by Milan et al. For G1. And the black dots are the results of our simulation. And you can see, I mean, this curve here compares the ratio of the two. And you can see for most radii, we really stay within 10% of the observed profile. So the only discrepant radii are somewhere the outermost radii. And the reason is just if you have a W0 equal or King model, you have a certain tidal radius, which was about here in the original simulation. Now, as the cluster evolves, it builds up in halo, but the Hubble time is just too short to fit all the observations. But at least in the center, which is most important for the question if there is a black hole, we get a fit to within 10%. And the second result we got out of our simulation is that also G1 is evolving towards mass segregation. This I've shown here. The black crosses is the distribution of all stars, and the triangles, for example, is the distribution of the bright stars. And what you can see in the outermost part, if you scale the bright stars to contain the total, same total number as the all stars, then in the outer part, you can fit. They basically follow the same distribution. And the reason is just the relaxation time is so long that there's no time for mass segregation in the outer part. But in the center, the bright stars have an overdensity by about a factor of 2 compared to all stars. Where the reason is just, I mean, in the center, a typical or average mass is only about 0.5 or 0.3 solar masses, but bright stars have about 0.7, 0.8 solar masses, so they sink into the center. And that means since you have an overdensity of bright stars, that the mass-to-light ratio is not constant in the center. And if you want to predict the velocity dispersion, you have to consider, you have to take a realistic M over L profile. But you can also see that the most massive stars, they have an overdensity in the center of already a factor of 10. And the reason is just, I mean, the more massive are, the more fast is mass segregation. And also, if you, when you continued that simulation, you found that co-collapse time for G1 is about 35 giga years. So that cluster is about 1/3 on the way to co-collapse. So as you've seen, I mean, the density profile we can fit very well. So what about the velocity dispersion measurements? Well, I think we can also fit them very well. The blue points is the velocity dispersion as measured by Gebhardt et al. And the solid curve is the velocity dispersion predicted by our model. And you can see, I mean, our points really lie nicely among the curve. There I have to say, I mean, here we not only tried to fitted our velocity dispersion to the HST measurements by Gebhardt et al., but also to the ground-based measurement by Jogowski et al., which is just the average velocity dispersion in the whole core. But still, even the Gebhardt et al. Data, we can fit very nicely, and if we run a chi-squared test, gives us a 20% probability that the observations agree with our dispersion profile. So basically, we can explain also the velocity dispersion of G1 without a black hole. Another thing which is quite interesting is that our best fitting mass to light ratio is 3.8, which is significantly higher than what Gebhardt et al. Have obtained in case of no central black hole, which was only 2.8. And the reason is, I mean, the cluster light is much more concentrated than the real, than the average stars. And if you have a more concentrated cluster, you need less mass to get the same velocity dispersion.
Can you give us some
maximum mass light, reasonable mass light rate you could expect for that. Because there was also a 2467-52 based on the pulsar.
It depends. I mean,
that was like 8 or 9.
I mean, it depends. If the cluster is going into quark collapse, then in principle I could explain any master light ratio, optimal master light ratio of a white dwarf. Because as I've shown you before, we have two different power laws. So the further you go into the center, the further the master light ratio will rise, just because the white dwarfs get more and more dominant. But I mean, I have some models. 10 is definitely no problem, I think. So I mean, these results were for some simulations which started from isotropic spherical King models. Now, as I've shown you before, I mean, one observation is it is rotating, and the other one is also it is flattened. And so the question is, can we do a little bit better in our comparison with G1? In order to do it, we started some merger simulations. So this is just one sequence. With merger simulations, we first just took two clusters on a parabolic orbit and threw them together and let the combined system when we work for some time until everything comes to rest. And then we took this cluster, set up a mass distribution, and then started evolving this cluster. And the idea is, I mean, either, okay, maybe G1 might have formed in such a way, or at least, I mean, such a simulation gives us the starting condition of a rotated and elliptic cluster, which we can compare with G1. I mean, we don't necessarily say that this is the way G1 has formed. And this slide shows you how the merger model is faring compared to G1. I mean, first thing is the density distribution. And now you can see we are also in the halo, quite close to the observed profile of G1. And the reason is just, I mean, if you have a merger, then during the merger, an extended halo will be created, and which gives us now a very good fit. Then the second thing is, I mean, the observed velocity dispersion, we can still very well predict, and the probability even went up to nearly 30% for this model. And the third thing is, there was some question about the rotation of M15. Well, G1 is also rotating, and at least for this cluster, our rotation profile is in very, very good agreement with observations. And the last thing is, the observed ellipticity comes also from the Maylor et al. Paper. And well, also our cluster created some ellipticity profile. That dashed curve shows you the ellipticity at the start of the simulation, which was about 0.25 throughout the cluster. Then, while the cluster is evolving, and especially in the inner part, you have relaxation, and the ellipticity is destroyed. And as you can see, after 12 giga years, we are also very, very close to where the observations are. In the outer part, you still have initial ellipticity, but then there's a drop, and in the observations, you see a similar drop. So basically, all observed quantities of G1, our model can fit, and it also does not need any black hole in the center to fit the velocity dispersion. And so I think neither M15 nor G1 would require a massive black hole in the center. I mean, okay, but at least you would also agree that the velocity dispersion itself wouldn't require a black hole.
I agree completely with that.
Yeah.
But that's not where the signature is. Okay, but my question is, for M15, you have to scale mass up by a factor of 25. For G1, you have to scale that up by a factor of 100.
Yep.
Are you concerned at all by these scalings?
I mean, at least for M15, I have another cluster running which started with 300,000 stars, and which would end up within a factor of 5 of M15. But unfortunately, I mean, it went into cost collapse last week, but then it also crashed, and I had no time to fix it. So, but I for M15, I wouldn't think, because, I mean, I had clusters starting from different particle numbers, but the central profiles were always the same. The runoff surface density with radius doesn't depend on the particle number or the orbit of a cluster or anything. I think that is a very, very fixed quantity. And also that mismatch between what you would expect and the really observed velocity dispersion, that was in all clusters. So for M15, I'm not concerned that our clusters are smaller.
Maybe this is just asking Carl's question in a more obnoxious way, but it seems to me that if you worry about fine details like wings and velocity profiles, that's the kind of thing that might be more susceptible to actually getting the end right.
Yeah. I guess the problem is, I mean, in our simulations we had about between 30 and 40 clusters. And okay, with such a low number, I mean, you can fit the velocity dispersion, but all these fine details would probably require a much, much larger number of initial simulations, and that we can't do by N-body simulations.
Yeah. Worry.
Yeah.
I would think that you'd be the first
person to say. Yeah, okay. That was in case if tidal effects are important. But I mean, what I studied was the tidal effect, if you add tidal effects to the relaxation processes. And then it's quite difficult to scale the clusters from low end to high end. But I mean, for G1, I would think tidal effects are absolutely unimportant. I calculated the tidal radius, it's about 800 parsecs or something. So, and all the observations stretch only to maybe 200 parsecs, even for the outermost data points for the density profile. So what I think for the central resolution, tidal effects are not important, and I would think we should be able to scale, at least for such simplified models which didn't contain primordial binaries or something. That should be fairly certain to be scaled.
Yeah, can maybe add something to that. And that is that there's also what you want to
dispersion. So far now, there have been two talks from theorists saying it's exactly what we expected, in which case the implication is we've learned nothing. So there must be something that you've learned. Either it's the initial or the final mass relation of white dwarfs that you put in is actually correct. Or so what is it that's been learned?
Well, I would say we have put some things right, because just for M15, the observers were just wrong. There was no central black hole.
Yeah. We're going to take their measurement at face value for the measurement of the parameters, and you're saying that you can make a model that agrees with those measurements.
Yeah.
So there must be something. There are free parameters in your model.
Mm-hmm.
I now presume in this case it must be the initial to final mass relation of white dwarfs that dominates this your calculation.
No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't think so, because I mean, I made for M15, I made simulations. I mean, first, my simulations didn't contain any black holes. If there are some 10 solar mass black holes, they would also very much dominate the evolution. And secondly, I mean, it doesn't matter if I have 0% neutron star retention rate or 100%, the final outcome is always the same.
That doesn't surprise me. The
yeah.
compact objects
yeah.
are
so, I mean,
the white dwarfs.
That's why Lars is saying that the white dwarfs are the key, but why?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, the neutron stars are also important.
Wait, sorry.
Yeah, okay, if you don't have neutron stars, then it's the white dwarfs who are doing the job, and then they are important. But if you have neutron stars, I mean, for wet simulations in the center, I had about 50% neutron stars, alpha mass and neutron stars, 50% in heavy mass white dwarfs. So we did it equally, we shared.
But hadn't either, you wouldn't be able to explain the data.
Yeah, okay, if I have no black holes, no neutron stars, and very, very low mass white dwarfs only, I can't explain the data, but that's also very unlikely.
Can I add a comment on that very quickly? That's actually said that's not even true, because if you only had 46 low mass white dwarfs, and the calculation ones, which I never published on the front, where you can work out a fraction of the number of binaries between 46 low mass white dwarfs, one to one, which is quite a common average for the binary binaries, right? And actually, the number of those is quite large, right? And if you have white dwarfs like that, 2.6 white dwarfs in a tight binary, they're small enough to be dynamically single, but also white, they're not as good as any more energy block handy, but still separation from all the white tensor or radar.
Yeah.
And you can actually get quite a few of those as well. So it doesn't even say that we have to have massive white dwarfs.
Yeah.
If you can't have massive white dwarfs, I think you can actually get quite a lot of these white
binary. Yeah. Binary. But when you need a really high binary fraction. So that these are important.
This is just a naive question of an interested but confused spectator in this debate. You've plotted certain things here, the simplest things, the velocity dispersion, and Carl's saying that you're looking at the wrong thing to find a black hole. So I'm just asking the naive question, could you analyze your data in the way Carl did, or could you give it to Carl for him to analyze in his way? And because I'm just listening to this debate, and you're saying you find one thing, and he's saying you're looking at the wrong thing. Or better still, could you run two simulations, one with a black hole and one without, give him the data, don't tell him which it is, and let him answer the question?
Okay, at least as far as the two types of simulations are concerned, where the problem is, our clusters are much, much smaller than the actual clusters which we try to model. And if you take the black hole as it is, for example, in M15, say 1,000, 2,000 solar masses, and scale that down, you end up with a 50 solar mass black hole in our clusters. And then it's very difficult to model such a cluster realistically, because when you have many, many length scales and time scales involved, for example, if you have encounters of the stars with the black hole. So it's not such an easy thing, I think, to do.
Yeah, I think it's a reference question of what can be learned here. If you make an analogy between the evolution of a very globular cluster and the evolution of a single star, in both cases, it is the heat transport and the mass transport in the case of a globular cluster around the half mass radius or the photosphere for a star. And the central parts of the star or the star cluster have to be in the right thermodynamic equilibrium as given by the boundary conditions further out. So if we get a boring result, it basically means that our theory is correct, which is nice but disappointing that it is boring. In the case of a star, if you look at the center of the star, like our sun, and you find there is something wrong with the neutrinos, that's exciting. So in this sense, it would be very exciting if there would be intermediate mass black holes, because that's not what you expect in the simplest theory. It's not what you get out of the simplest model. So if you find a discrepancy, that would be great. But a priori, you shouldn't be too surprised if you find something boring. It just means that we know what we're doing.
Well, but you're putting in an initial final mass relation that, for example, you don't know. Where it's been measured in the Galactic Field is for solar metallicity stars.
Sure.
So you made an assumption there, and what you're saying is that it's worn out by the observations.
The point is that heavy white dwarfs can do something very similar as what neutron stars do. I mean, it's not sensitive to these things because it's all driven by the outer boundary conditions. So as long as you have something in there which can more or less do the job, then in first approximation, you shouldn't be too surprised that it is difficult to discriminate if you really have very detailed observations and very detailed theoretical models. You might hope to resolve that, but it's not that easy. And the type of opinion on this level is theoretically not surprising.
Okay.
Couple comments. You're not going to be able to extract the non-Gaussianity of the velocity profile from your models because your number of stars is too small. I've tried this, you don't have enough stars, I guarantee you.
I mean, for G1 I had 65,000 stars.
Yeah, but the number of stars you have in the core is...
I had 10 snapshots, so I have 500,000 stars. I would think for outer radii it's no problem, because if you look, for example, at the velocity dispersion, I mean, the other bars are very small. So that's no problem, but for the inner radii, of course, it's too hard.
Okay, you're not going to be able to do the trick of giving Gephardt your models because you don't have enough particles in your model for Gephardt to extract noise-free velocity profiles and show non-Gaussian properties. I do want to remind people again that the rotation in M15 is rising at small radii. Nobody is addressing this issue, and it's probably a big clue. And there's another question I don't quite understand, which is, in a core collapse model, the mass-to-light ratio can rise to arbitrarily large values as you go deeper and deeper into core collapse at smaller and smaller radii. But with a black hole model, the mass contained inside given radius is constant as you go to smaller and smaller radii. Whereas in a core collapse model, it's a smaller and smaller fraction of the cluster that's participating in the core collapse. And the signatures should separate out in any model. So if you have good enough resolution data, we should be able to separate out the core collapse models and the black hole models for any finite degree of core collapse.
Yeah, I agree.
And again, you're going to need more particles to do that. Scaled-up models are not going to resolve that.
Yeah, also, just the observations have to get to also to smaller radii, because as I've shown you in my core collapse cluster, basically you predict a nearly flat velocity distribution in the center. But if you have a black hole, then at some point it should get into the Keplerian rise. Yeah. Okay, what do
you... And Carlos made that point. That's a very important point. And that's something that can be extracted from large end models, not from small end models.
For most radii, my model should have large enough inner root, yes. Only in the very center it will be difficult. But then it will also be difficult for the observations,
and
I guess. I didn't try to determine any parameters there.
Okay, I don't think you have enough particles in small radii in small models.
There's always a limit there. Limiting idea.
I think so on the issue of number of stars, we heard that the Monte Carlo methods can handle a lot more stars. Couldn't that be done? Couldn't the same problem be done easier, maybe? Any Monte Carlo types?
I have a comment as an observer about this small number statistics problem. A few years ago, Sosin and I tried to settle the simple question, is there a core or a cusp, by looking at every single star in the center of M15 with excellent resolution in the FOC, and we decided that we just didn't have enough stars to answer it. I'm afraid you're going to run into that here, observationally, not just theoretically.
Well, maybe Carl can answer this question. Is there actually enough stars in the observation to see the deviations from the Gaussian profile clearly?
The only way this would be really convincing, I think, is, I guess addressing more to what Carl just said, would be to measure stars in the cusp of the black hole potential, which, as Ivan just told us, contains probably no visible stars, at least at FOC limits in the first place. Mm. So it's a no-win situation. The other quick comment was that in answer to what Lars is asking about, or what have we learned, I think what you've shown here with the 0% retention neutron star case that you could make it work with white dwarfs is a really important result. It shows that massive white dwarfs could do it, and we are seeing evidence for massive white dwarfs in the cluster CVs. So we know they're there. This just says something about what their total number or contribution to the mass must be.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I have one comment. If I would be an observer, I would try to look at the omega cell for a signature of a massive central black hole, because that cluster is definitely not in core collapse. So the M15 scenario that we presented will not work, everything will be very similar to G1. But on the other hand, I mean, if, omega sin is much, much closer, and you should be able to get into the center much, much better than in G1. So I would think that should be really the best globular cluster.
Omega sin has a pretty strong signature for a black hole. I'm not sure I'm afraid.
Okay. So when there's more work to do for me.
I'll try asking the same question for the, I don't know, fifth time. Dynamically, it makes absolutely no difference whether you have a component of 1.4 solar mass something or a component of 1.2 solar mass something. As long as they're dark and heavier than anything else, it makes absolutely no difference. In fact, in the old way of doing the multi-mass Foucault-Pauve models, they just had bins of things with a certain mass, and they didn't even tell you what they were. They're just bins of objects with a certain mass. So the relevant way to ask a question about what you have learned is to ask, what is the minimum number or fraction that you need in dark remnants, whatever they are, 1.2 or 1.4 makes no difference. What is the minimum number that you need in order to explain the observations?
Hmm.
Maybe you haven't done it yet, but that's the way to ask the question. Then you can really constrain.
Okay, since we only have two different cases, it's still quite difficult for us to answer. We would have three more models, probably.
And that the people who do the star evolution can tell you whether this is reasonable or not. So if that, maybe it works more than to be all that works.